really good up here, you know.
All right. Well, maybe you're high, too. Warning. Hits taken on this show are larger than they appear. Do not try this at home. These people are professionals. Or at least they pay me to say that.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
A public service message from the Russ Belville Show. It's time for the Russ Belville Show's Cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Earlywine is a professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and a leading author and researcher on cannabinoids and health, who pins the Ask Dr. Mitch column for High Times magazine.
Welcome back, everybody. Time for our Cannabis Q&A segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. How you doing, Dr. Mitch?
Crazy time. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Great to have you on the air again. We got so many studies to get to, so much to talk about. It's been a busy week in marijuana research, so let's get right to it. The first study we're taking a look at here reiterates something we've heard before, the threat that cannabis use may pose for the risk of heart attack or stroke. What is this latest study telling us? Does it tell us anything different than what we've debunked in the past?
Well, so this, you know, it's correlational work. It's not really quite the sort of thing we want to hear, but there is a small but statistically significant covariation between risk for stroke or risk for heart attack. Again, we're talking about, you know, these enormous samples and relatively small effects, and so it's hard to know what to make of it. Covarying out some of the, you know, correlates that often go with this is also very, very difficult. The bottom line is if we, you know, exercise, take good care of ourselves, eat right, and try to keep our blood pressure down, that's pretty much about all we can do.
Is there any other activities that correlated about the same level as the risk that cannabis may pose?
Well, what's funny is it's not even big enough for most, like, epidemiological studies to get too worked up over. We're talking about associations that I don't really have a good parallel with. Anytime you're less than doubling your risk for something, usually folks just say there's, you know, there's statistical significant thing here, but it's not enough to make a lot out of. And we're way below that. I think the cardiac risk was only up by 10% and 26% on the stroke.
Mm, okay. Kind of like if I buy two tickets for the Powerball, I've doubled my chances of winning.
Exactly, but it's still so small, and now this is like buying one and a fourth.
One and a fourth ticket. Okay, let's take a look at this next study, which is something that reiterates something that we've heard anecdotally from many patients that suffer from seizure disorders, and this one is how epilepsy patients are turning to cannabis rather than their pharmaceuticals and even seeking relief from their pharmaceuticals in cannabis. What more can we make of this?
This is wild because we do know that there is a direct effect of the cannabinoids on seizure rates. This is saying the side effects of some of the medications that folks use for those very same things can also be controlled with cannabis. So it's like here's a double dose, if you will, a chance to make good use of cannabis as an anti-seizure medication itself, but also to make the other anti-seizure meds easier to take. And, you know, we think of cannabis as an anti-nausea and just a general ease of onset for any kind of gastrointestinal impact of any other sort of drug. And these epileptic drugs aren't notorious for those kinds of things, but they definitely, you know, do occur for some folks. And so it's kind of nice to know that cannabis can not only help those side effects, but then add a little extra boost to those anti-seizure effects.
We have a question from our live chat room on YouTube. Our viewers there want to know if there's been any significant research on the effects of THCV, one of the cannabinoids.
Yeah, THCV is still pretty much in the lore stage. So we're hearing a lot about its potential as far as altering appetite, perhaps counter to what we're accustomed to for plain old THC. So THCV might actually decrease appetite, whereas THC is sort of legendary for its ability to increase appetite. And then otherwise, we're really just in the rat lab stage with this one, and it just doesn't have the publications that even, you know, CBD has, never mind how much THC itself does.
Okay, the next couple of studies we have to take a look at have to do with the subject of cannabis and driving, and the first one comes from my home state of Oregon, where our Measure 91 mandated a earmark of money for the state to investigate cannabis and driving and to evaluate whether or not we ought to have a per se DUID or what we ought to do when it comes to cannabis and impaired driving. And the headline I got from this one said that the Oregon DUI study shows there's no epidemic of stoned drivers. Is that what you get from the study, or some other good news from this?
I mean, the bottom line is there was a modest increase statewide on sort of drug-related, particularly cannabis-related traffic fatalities. So I think in 2004 there were 13, and then 2015 there were 16. So, I mean, we're talking about a relatively rare phenomenon, thank God, statewide, and that these numbers are really pretty small. We, you know, always reiterate anybody who does use cannabis should be super careful about driving and wait till the impact of the plant has decreased dramatically. And we do see modest but, detectable changes in the ability to say, hit the brake quickly or steer in laboratory work on cannabis. But the, you know, THC-related fatal crashes are not up in really any of the states where cannabis has had looser laws, and it's not the kind of thing that we should really go crazy about. If people will focus on good driving habits and just make sure their general motor skills are good, that's going to be fine. The idea of a blood limit for THC is probably not a good idea given the disparate rates of tolerance we have across different users.
Yeah, and the good news is that Oregon report does recommend against any sort of per se limit, saying the science doesn't show that there's any correlation like there is with alcohol in a dose-dependent manner. The follow-up we've got on this comes from Colorado, where there was a survey of Colorado's cannabis consumers, and they found that 57% of the cannabis consumers in Colorado admitted that they had driven at least once within a two-hour window after consuming cannabis. My fear is that this kind of information would be taken by lawmakers to say, we need to detect whether someone's used within 2 hours, regardless of whether or not they're impaired by that. What do you make of this data, this survey data?
I understand your concern, and I'm just sad that that misinterpretation is so likely. What really matters is your ability to drive or your, performance on any kind of motor skill tasks. And that duration is going to be so dose dependent and so varied as far as your own personal tolerance is concerned that any kind of heuristic about a certain number of hours or a certain blood THC level is just a really bad idea.
Yeah, I'm concerned because of the technology that's being developed with respect to breath testing, which they say only detects THC in the breath within a 2 hour window. And I'm afraid they'll match that technology with statistics that say, well, in general, the general population, people that drive within 2 hours are going to be impaired. What can we do to fight back against that? What kind of science would we use in that battle?
I mean, we really do have some pretty compelling evidence that the roadside sobriety tests have a lot more promise. And so I would be much more interested in if, you can walk a straight line and juggle and ride a unicycle than I can if you can pass a breath test of THC exposure.
All right. We'll keep our eye on that and try to educate as many people as we can, especially some of the decision makers, to understand the science behind cannabis and driving impairment. Now, we've reported many times on the science between cannabis and cancer, all the way back to Dr. Tashkin in 2006, finding less incidence of head, neck, and lung cancer among cannabis consumers. This latest study claims there is less risk of bladder cancer among cannabis consumers. Give us the details on that, Dr. Mitch.
I mean, it's wild because, you know, anytime we have something correlational like this going in the other direction, I'm always saying, hey, we really need a replication and we have to be super concerned. But this is one that's shown up previously and something that I don't want to let folks think, hey, your risk of bladder cancer is going to drop simply by using the plant. But we've got, some pretty impressive data as far as this goes. It's just that this type of cancer is relatively rare. And so I don't want to make too much of it, just as we were sort of joking about the same thing with buying the lottery ticket. Buying a bad lottery ticket is also a possibility with these kinds of cancers. So if you can do anything you can to avoid bladder cancer in particular, don't smoke those nasty cigarettes. It's still worth doing. You may have a slight buffering effect if you do use cannabis, but don't count on that. Do everything you can to take good care of yourself.
So is that a suggestion that there's a tendency to overblow these correlations when something's negative about cannabis and to underreport them when something's good?
Sad but true. So I do feel like this is one that actually has replicated now. It's, again, it's not a halving of the rate of, you know, just as I was saying, hey, we got to double something before we should get too concerned about it. We aren't decreasing the rate by a half all the way on this, but it's definitely there, and it seems to have replicated in previous data.
All right. For our final minute, we've got one last bit of research, some new research on cannabis fear and anxiety and how cannabis may help in those areas. What can we take away from this study?
Well, so this one, it's interesting because, you know, I'm always up and down about how behavioral interventions are much better for the anxiety-related disorders than any kind of pharmacological one. But this one really does focus on cannabidiol, which isn't psychoactive in the first place, as we've mentioned. And this is another phenomenon where we've got multiple data sets now all pointing that, you know, small doses of CBD really can have an impact on basically just the way anxious stimuli are processed. And there's really no, you know, negative side effect with CBD. So it seems like the potential for giving this a chance seems really worth it, and it's not like there's anything to worry about. I still would encourage folks to, you know, seek a nice self-help book on anxiety, or go ahead and see a therapist a few sessions. But this is a such a promising and low side effect kind of treatment that a pure CBD intervention seems like it's worth trying.
All right. Sounds good. Dr. Mitch Earlywine joins us every Monday to discuss cannabis science here on the show, but you can also get a hold of him directly through email and keep it private if you like by emailing 420research@gmail.com. That's 420research@gmail.com. Dr. Mitch is also the host of Burning Issues on CannabisRadio.com, a weekly podcast. We'll give you 30-minute updates and interviews on the latest in cannabis science. Dr. Mitch, thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Take care.
All right, stay tuned, folks. When we come back, time for a radical rant on what has happened in Colorado since they've legalized marijuana.
This is the Russ Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.